Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio War Nerd. The date today is March 22nd, 2023, and this is episode 370. You are listening to Radio War Nerd. Subscribe at patreon.com/RadioWarNerd. I'm Mark Ames in Rochester, up on Lake Ontario, and I'm online with the War Nerd, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, in Glasgow. I don't know. You want to talk about your tooth? I mean, it ain't good.
If I sound a little slow today, it's because I'm not functioning very well. I have had complications since they pulled out a molar about 10 days ago. And it won't stop hurting, and I can't sleep, and other complications. So that's my excuse in advance for if the synapses aren't firing too well.
Yeah. Tooth pain is no joke. And yeah, the link between tooth pain and cognition is very well documented. I mean, I read a lot about that, regarding American children, because I mean, I can't remember the statistics, but it's something like, you know, at least, I don't know, 1 in 6 children can't see a dentist, can't afford it in America, some huge number, and they have tooth problems, cavities, and so on. And then they can't learn. And there was a time early on in the financial crisis, early on in the Obama era, when there were some state, I want to say maybe it was Alabama even, or some states or some, they were thinking of introducing a program to provide free dental care for people, like really poor people under a certain income level, because the children were just screwed for life, not even from just being poor and having teeth and pain, but they wouldn't be able to learn. And the Dental Association stepped in, lobbied hard, and had it killed, because they figure, you know, out of those children, 1 in 6's parents are going to scrounge up the money to pay them, and the other 5 out of 6 children can go screw themselves. That's life. But you know, wow, the dentists need their boats or something, and so they got
it. Doesn't even sound smart financially. Like, haven't they made a killing out of Medicare? I mean, couldn't
they
make another kill?
Not the way they put it. Out of Medicaid, it's very hard to get dental care through Medicaids.
I know, but yeah. I mean, I was making an analogy thing, rather than, I mean, they made money out of that, I thought, but
Maybe not. I don't know. They could make more other ways. I think they did the math, and it was pretty, and they also, there's also the, you know, these are right-wing people. There's also the, you know, today you offer really poor kids a bit of free dental care, tomorrow we're all in gulags and we have Stalin in power. It's the slippery slope argument. I mean, I think it was that same group or some version of it that in the 50s spread around the whole fluoridated water causes communism because it was hurting their business thing. I think
That thing is still going strong.
Yeah,
it's too bad. I mean, part of the reason that I end up in situations like this is that we were in the water district that didn't fluoridate its water. We were about, you know, half a mile from the border of the water district that did fluoridate its water. And the people I know who live there, grew up there, their teeth are fine.
Yeah, it works. I mean, it's just, it's so simple. It works. And did they ever bring the fluoridated water into your district? I mean, that's insane. It's an insane story. I guess it started late, but
they might have, or maybe not, because all those places like Pleasant Hill went right wing, very, very right wing. And there's a bill that I just saw introduced in Oklahoma now to prohibit any district from adding fluoride to its water. So they're riding high again.
Is that they think it turns children into trans or something? Or what's the thing that scares them now?
I don't know. Frogs, maybe? I don't know. it might be trans now. Yeah. I don't know.
Because it was communism.
Rosicrucians tomorrow. Who knows?
All right. So we're going to have a great interview coming up with, well, we're going to talk about the 20th anniversary of the Iraq war, because why not? We're a war podcast, yeah. And we got to put in our two cents.
The Warner came out of our frustration. I mean, yours and mine, because I remember walking around on the streets of Moscow, fulminating against all these Acela Court or pundits who were suddenly pivoting to become military experts. And I remember my tooth-gnashing rage at that. And how dare these people? They didn't go through what I went through, spending their adolescence in the reference room of the library going through Jane's.
Someday I'll show them. Yeah. All these absolute dorks, Canadian dorks from Ivy Leagues, talking like George Patton in the movie Patton or something. They're all so tough all of a sudden. Yeah.
Yep.
That's where the Warnerd came from. It was great that Warnerd hit it off quickly in the exile. And it had to do with, it was in that interim between Afghanistan and, so it was 2002, I think we launched it sometime in 2002, between Afghanistan and the invasion of Iraq.
I remember the moment when, when it did hit big, because suddenly I not only had permission, but I had every good reason to write in backyard California colloquial, which I had never been able to write in before, and it got really popular. Mm-hmm. And I remember the moment when I thought, if I went pro-Iraq war, this could probably make a lot of money. And I could not do it, not because I'm a moral person, because no, I'm not ever a moral person, but because...
Snobbery.
How dare they? These fucking amateurs. I mean, I was not going to give them the satisfaction, so went the other way. And a lot of people were pissed off. They expected the Warner to lend his voice to... the jingoistic fever that came over the U.S. at the time. But since we were both in Moscow at that time, I moved from New Zealand to Moscow around 2002. The experience was very different there. It was like watching someone with a bad fever who was separated from you by a pane of glass. You could watch the thrashing, but luckily it wasn't contagious.
Yeah, that's a very good way to put it. It looked crazy. It looked crazy. And you sort of alternated between, this is pretty funny. Look how crazy they are. This sort of validates my, the general notion of nihilistic comedy or something. But, and the other hand, like, they can't be serious, though. They can't be.
For one thing, it was so cheesy. The return of cheese, that really got to me.
Oh, yeah.
But also, at a more serious level, no one seemed to think about guerrilla war as a possible contingency to be dealt with. It was like, how fast can we get to Baghdad? How long do you think it will take? And it was... That mission accomplished tableau on the aircraft carrier that's so often mocked today wasn't as far from mainstream thinking as you might like to think.
Again, I think you have to go back, to Afghanistan, which fell quickly and seemed to be yesterday's news if you wanted it to be, because the Taliban and al-Qaeda had skedaddled pretty thoroughly at first. And Kosovo, right, which looms large over the Iraq war.
It really does. People tend to minimize that link, but very important.
So first, we're going to talk with Seth Harp about an episode and in kind of a larger context, a hidden and really ugly episode that he just wrote about for Rolling Stone in the Iraq war. And we'll let him tell the story. It's a pretty amazing story, and it's not an unusual one. It just was not the sort of story that was reported much. So let's get to our interview with Seth Harp. Okay, we are really excited and happy to welcome back to the show previous Radio Warner guest Seth Harp. He's contributing editor at Rolling Stone. And also has written for Harper's Magazine. In fact, the last time we talked to Seth for episode 328, he had just returned from Ukraine, from reporting on the war there, the Foreign Legion, for Harper's Magazine. And we only talked briefly with Seth then about his own experience in the Iraq War. And so today we asked him to come on, and he so generously agreed to come on to talk about both his own experience and also this incredible story that I had missed when he first published it in 2016 in Rolling Stone. It's called Abandoned in Iraq, Inside Two Soldiers' Harrowing Escape, the True Story of U.S. Soldiers Left for Dead in Iraq, Their Epic Battle for Survival, and the Military Cover-Up That Kept Them Silent Until Now. So that's the headline and the subheader of the story that you wrote. So this was, first published, 13 years after the invasion. But as somebody who was a veteran there and then who was a reporter who's reported on stories from there, I mean, how unusual was it to find a story like this? And then we should walk us through it versus how often did you ever... how was it received, I guess? So how hard was it to find stories like this? How often did they actually happen? And, how was it even received at the time?
Yeah, I mean, really the lasting lesson that I took from it is how spotty the historical record of war tends to be, and how many events just don't make it into the historical record at all. Because, this event happened in 2004, and the only reason I knew about it was because it involved my unit and guys that I knew. I wasn't there in Alamara, but I was back at the unit headquarters. And so when I went to journalism school, more than 10 years later, about 10 years later, approximately 10 years later, 11 years later, I had to write a story, a master's project. I was kind of thinking like, hey, I know this crazy thing that happened back in the day, which was kind of vague. It was so much stuff had been going on at the time. And my platoon had its own issues, but I thought, what would happen if I went and tracked those guys down and figured out exactly what happened? So I went and interviewed them all and got the documents from them and pieced it together. And come to realize it was probably one of the biggest battles in Iraq, mm-hmm. of 2004, and just a total disaster. And coming right before Bush's election, the re-election in 2004, I mean, the military was at pains to suppress any kind of bad news at that time, as it had done in the case of Jessica Lynch and Pat Tillman and so forth. But it definitely would have been something on that level had it come out. But it didn't, and only by chance was I able to reconstruct it later.
So can you summarize the story for us?
Well, there's this saying, this stereotype. It's actually an official slogan of the U.S. Army, that we never leave soldiers behind. Like, you never leave your buddy behind in combat. Well, actually, yeah, that happens all the time. Surprise, of course. Because you have a situation like this ambush and my unit's convoy that we had sent down to Kuwait from Balad had been ambushed by a much larger element of a Shia militia called the Mahdi Army, which was led by a cleric named Muqtada al-Sadr.
Yeah, that was Muqtada's fourth, right.
Uh-huh. And it was one mistake after another. We talk a lot about the perfidy of the media and government fabricating the weapons of mass destruction conspiracy theory. And the Saddam al-Qaeda conspiracy theory. But, probably less attention is paid to how mismanaged the war was in the early years. Like, it was really bad. I mean, they probably could have gotten away they did get away with it. What am I saying? But one thing that really discredited the Bush administration and made it much more difficult for Bush to win re-election and led to, I think, lasting damage to the Republican Party's reputation was... how poorly run the Iraq War was in the first couple of years. And, this is an example of that. My unit being a reserve unit, being sent on a convoy, with no air support, with no quick reaction forces, just a bunch of guys who had just basic combat training. into this zone where it was actually controlled by the British. There's no communication between the Americans and the British. The British would have told us, absolutely do not come out here. You know, we can barely leave. Every time we leave the base, we take fire. You know, we're losing men. They would have warned us away from Alamara, but because there was no communication, my units sent a convoy just blindly rolling into that town, and the Mahdi army just absolutely feasted on that convoy. Overwhelming small arms fire.
You were in that same, your unit that you joined, but had you joined at that time in 2004?
Yeah, I was there in Iraq. So it was my unit. We were based in, when I say my unit, I mean, it was my battalion.
Right.
We were based at Camp Anaconda, later known as Joint Base Balad in Balad. Mm-hmm. You know, the way these things work is that so a job needs to be done. They'll gather people together to create like a little task force,
right?
Little element. This one was about 70 guys, including guys from my company and my platoon. Okay. So they were just grabbed, mostly depending upon what trucks you're charged. I had a certain truck that I drove, and had that truck been needed for that convoy, I would have been on that convoy. But my truck was not needed. So they pulled together a group of about 70 guys from my unit and sent it down to Kuwait. And I remember watching them leave out the gate because of what happened later. So they get down there. This is on May 1st, 2004. And they took an overwhelming weight of small arms fire, mortars, and RPGs. Two of the guys in my battalion were killed right away. Oscar Medina and Ramon Ojeda were their names. One guy from Chicago, and the other one was from San Diego. And then, you know, there was the stories about a different pair of sergeants, one named Stuart Redis and the other one was named Fernando Torres. Those guys were actually in my platoon. Like, I was close to them. I knew them. I was in contact with them on a daily basis. See, we didn't have any vehicle armor at that time because of the whole, that famous Rumsfeld moment where he talks about how you go to the army, you go to war with the army that you have, not the one you wish you had.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I got to say, I mean, so many things you're saying here right now, going in, no communication, no real armor, no air cover. It's basically like Russia going into Ukraine, except that the Mahdi army didn't have the NATO training and the NATO weapons and so on, but they could still do a lot of damage. I mean, because when the Russians did that, everyone was acting like, my God, we've never seen anything like this in like a century of such poor planning. And you know, we're going to chalk this up to Russian barbarism. Russians don't care about lives, they're animals. But I was remembering, like, that was a huge deal in 2004, 2005, how people from, you know, mothers and fathers were having to mail armor to their children to, like, weld it onto their Humvees or, right? I mean, that seems to have been lost, I guess.
Well, we made our own armor. We found this pile of scrap metal out in this base in Kuwait. I can't remember the name of that base anymore. But we found a bunch of metal there, and because we were army engineers, we all had that. We had the tools, and some of us had the knowledge to help others to weld pieces of armor onto the trucks, onto their doors, onto above the windshields, places that were vulnerable to taking small arms fire. One of those, I can't say that it saved my life. I don't know what would have happened absent it. But there was a time when I was driving over the bridge in Samara. In October 2004, someone's bullet, I don't know if it was a sniper, it could have been accidental because there was a lot of shooting going on at the time, but a bullet hit the door and my leg was against the door and I could feel the reverberation in my leg. And then afterwards, I looked out to the outside of it and there was like a groove, on the rusted surface, there was like a polished silver groove where that bullet had hit right on top of my femur. Or, you know, whoa. I could say the femoral artery area. So I don't know.
Wow.
It made me think that, hey, that might have saved my life having that there. But I'll tell you what, the two guys I mentioned earlier, Redis and Torres, the homemade armor they had on their trucks absolutely saved their lives. because their truck was disabled in the middle of the kill zone during this ambush. And they were hunkered down behind those pieces of metal that they had bolted to their doors. And that was the only thing between them and, you know, all of the bullets that, that were coming down on them, hot and heavy. And folks who are interested in it can read the story, of course. I'll try not to go into every single detail.
It's a great story, though, so you can give us some details anyway. It is an amazing story.
Well, they were left behind in the middle of the kill zone. Because the rest of the convoy was just trying to get the hell out of there. And once they regrouped on the outskirts of the city, the commander who was in charge, you know, who was just a second lieutenant, if I'm not mistaken, he may have been a first lieutenant by that point.
24-year-old,
24 years old. It was literally the first time he had ever been outside the wire.
Wow.
I tried to go easy on him in the story that I wrote because I really do understand you know, the dilemma he was faced with, because, you know, he had two guys dead. Also, five guys had been shot. And some of them had been shot. One of them had been shot in the neck. I remember that. Others had been shot in the arms, leg, torso, and they're bleeding. Guys are screaming in pain, and they had to, you know, he just made the decision, like, Rivas and Torres are almost certainly dead. There's no chance. If we go back in and try to get their bodies, it's just going to lead to more people getting killed. And he made the decision right then to just ride on, because there were no comms, like there's no communication at all. They had no, it's just mind-boggling how poorly equipped units like mine were, in the sense that, like, in a moment like that, we couldn't even reach like a larger element, like an infantry element.
Sorry, but was the idea in the army that, you know, the threat wasn't understood yet, or had the Mahdi army already made its move? I remember they made their big move, I think in April.
It was April
2004.
Yeah.
Did people know that this was not a safe zone?
I don't know what they knew. Our battalion intelligence officers would have been charged with that, with knowing that, but they could have just read it in the news if they wanted to. But, you know, the real issue was that the shit just didn't work. Like, the radios just didn't work. It's just unbelievable. You know, they had these SIMGAR or SIGAR radios. Can't remember the acronym anymore. I think it's SIGAR. But I never got one, could get one to work in the time that I was in the Army. The equipment was really cruddy to a shocking degree, considering how much all this stuff costs.
It's the F-35 model scaled down to radio size. It's crazy. Oh, my God.
It was also the advent of the sort of cell phone era. So, you know, people would just start using their own cell phones. We mostly used walkie-talkies that had been bought from like Walmart before we left.
Jeez.
But when
this is wild.
When Rivas and Torres got left behind, they had nothing. They had no walkie-talkie. They had no radio. And when they bailed out of that truck to take cover nearby, they forgot their canteens because they had unbuckled their vests and belts when they were driving. So they bailed out of that truck with nothing but their personal weapons and the extra magazines that they had on them, on their persons, which wasn't that many, you know, basic load. I can't remember how much that is anymore, but I don't know, maybe like six mags. And, you know, they're completely alone, surrounded by an enemy element of at least 100. I can't estimate. I really don't know. By the way, years after this happened, I was in a bookstore, and I saw this mass market paperback by a British Army sniper named Dan Mills, his memoir called Sniper One. And I looked at the back of it and saw that he had been in Alamara in 2004. And I thought, I'll be damned, that's right where that ambush happened. Rivas and Torres got left behind. Started reading it and almost fell out of my chair because he actually witnessed this event. This British Army sniper, who was in a sniper's nest about a mile away, actually saw it all happen.
Wow.
Not up close. You know, I have a more granular view of it after interviewing these guys. But
through a scope or something?
Through his scope. He was watching it through his scope. Yeah. So should anyone doubt the veracity of the story, it's also corroborated by Dan Mills, as well as I obtained the after-action report from Well, I didn't actually obtain it through FOIA. Anytime someone dies, there's going to be an after-action report, that's for sure. So I knew they must have done it. I actually managed to get a copy from Redis. A sympathetic officer had exfiltrated one to him, and he gave it to me. I submitted a FOIA request on the Army for this document, and they said that it didn't exist. Told them that there was no such thing. So that was another lesson learned.
When they say a FOIA document, a document you're trying to FOIA doesn't exist and can't therefore be FOIA'd, which is to say declassified or whatever, what is the penalty for lying? Like, why don't they lie all the time? I always kind of wonder. Or how often do they lie, you know?
Actually, if I'm not mistaken, there are severe penalties for government employees who lie in connection to FOIA. I could be wrong about that. I remember I was reading a statute once and I was impressed by it. I was like, damn, that's serious. But you know what? The way that they probably are able to do it in this case, like I submitted I wrote the story when I was in journalism school. So I wasn't that proficient with FOIA, and I submitted it to the U.S. Army, just like the overall Army. And they probably did some cursory search. Who knows? I mean, this is a massive organization. Right. And in order to really get a document like that, you would need to specify the command.
Right.
It would need to be a more specific command. It's all in that document, the after-action review, which was signed by Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, who was the highest ranking officer in Iraq at that time. He was commander of multinational forces in Iraq.
Right.
So this all definitely happened. It just didn't come out at the time. But like I was saying, these two guys take cover in this. It turns out it was an abandoned prison, a prison that was under construction. And for some reason, they had stopped building it in Amara. And I was actually able to identify this building using satellite maps. And they took shelter there because it was filled with rubble and they were able to control the entrance. And keep these enraged, because the people of Amara were extremely opposed to the continued presence of British and American troops in their city. And the British had managed to, have been fighting them for weeks and had managed to come to some kind of agreement where they were going to just remain in their base and not patrol, and then the people were going to stop doing their nightly mortar attacks. And they had a very tentative, détente with the British.
Yeah, like an understanding, basically, which happens a lot, yeah.
More or less. And so then my unit just comes plowing in, completely heedless of all of this.
It's amazing. It's a total lack of communication between British intelligence.
It leads to this massive firefight in which many civilians are killed. Some of the most horrific details, because, you know, it wasn't just these two guys. I interviewed everyone I could that was on the convoy, and they talked about how people were just laying dead in the street. Lots of people were just laying dead in the street.
Yeah.
And but these guys are able to hold off the Mahdi fighters until about sundown. They're really low on ammo. I talked to both of those guys who, needless to say, were left severely traumatized.
Yeah.
Redis probably said that he killed about 10 guys at that doorway. And then Torres, who really struggled with it because he's a Catholic and just couldn't handle he was a very devout Catholic, and just he really struggled with the people that he had killed that day. But he said he killed about 5 guys right then at that doorway to that prison. But being almost completely out of ammunition, they had to fall back into like this tower in the back. And again, I will not belabor the story, because there's lots of other things to talk about the Iraq War besides this. But they take cover in this tower, and then finally, when they're down to their last 2 bullets, they sneak out and just like jump from about a 30-foot drop, which the Mahdi fighters did not see because they were on the inside of the prison.
It's really cinematic, I have to say. I mean, it's a grim as hell story. It's not a heroic story, but it is very cinematic, and it's like kind of a Black Hawk Down, but just grim as hell kind of story, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I tried for many times and was in talks to get it made into a movie. But the problem is that the moral of it is just, it would just be so, you know, the sort of sacred cows. Topple's sacred cows, and just very, very depressing.
The army leaves people behind.
Yeah, the difference between Black Hawk Down and that is really interesting. In that,
yes,
in Black Hawk Down, of course, these are elite units, and they're presented as elite units, but they're up against this horrifying new kind of opposing force. There's nothing about how they don't have basic supplies, air cover, or intelligence. Right.
They're not abandoned because they're being watched by cameras above, you know, by the commanders out in base. It's just that they can't reach them. So it doesn't make the U.S. military look bad. But this is about bad intelligence, bad communications, taking crap care of soldiers, not giving a shit about them, lying about not leaving any soldiers behind. It's all the, it overturns everything in a way. And yet within that, there's these two guys who have this incredible struggle to stay alive.
And far from being special forces soldiers, we were in, you know, like the sort of least elite unit in the whole U.S. Army. And then on top of that, these guys were like the old guys in the unit, because Rivas was 40 and Torres was 38, which was for the army is old.
Jumping down a 30-foot wall at 40.
Both of them were left with lifelong back injuries from that jump. But you know, coming at from a sort of writerly perspective, that's what attracted me to the story. That's what I like about the story, was that these guys were such underdogs.
Yes.
And they from after having jumped, Rivas carried Torres part of the way, because Torres was very fucked up. His back was very fucked up right then. So he carried him out into the desert, and they came to what was essentially an open sewer or some sort of drainage line. And they traversed the sewer to a highway and used their weapons, which were, as I said, you know, empty except for one bullet apiece. They had saved their each of them had saved their final round, but they used those empty magazines to kind of bluff, and they literally hijacked a civilian's car. It was a little dinky Kia sedan with four people in it. They ran off three of them, said, "Get lost." And then forced the fourth guy, the driver, they forced him at gunpoint to drive them to a Iraqi police station. Or they didn't know. Of course, they can't communicate with the they don't speak any Arabic, and the Iraqis didn't speak any English. But you know, these guys are completely done at this point. You know, they're completely beat to hell, and totally exhausted, and above all thirsty, because like during this whole time they had no water, and May in Iraq is very, very, very hot. The lack of water, they both have emphasized that continuously to me. It was really, really, if they could have, you know, just done one thing differently, grabbed those canteens.
John, that reminds me of a Warnerd, one of your Warnerd pieces some years ago, when everyone was talking Civil War and, you know, who's going to be best prepared and which gun do you need for the American Civil War coming? And your Warnerd piece was like, whoever has control of the water reservoirs is the one who wins. Like, screw your arsenal. Take control of the water reservoirs and you got it.
At least west of the Mississippi, that's going to be the obvious choke point.
Anyway, sorry, go ahead.
One of the things that Dan Mills says in his book is that he emphasizes that Rivas and Torres got really lucky in their choice of they're accidentally ending up at that police station, because he said most of those cops in Amara were completely in league with the Mahdi army and would have just turned them over right away. Somehow, I don't know by what miracle, these two police officers at this Iraqi police station were on good terms with the British and summoned like a British patrol, which came and picked them up. And then from there, they were rescued. And then they actually took them from there to a place called Camp Abu Naji, which is just north of Amara. And they actually, right then, were reunited with the lieutenant who had made the decision to leave them behind. And they actually...
That's awkward, as they say.
Yeah.
It was this crazy, chaotic moment where, like, the units, on the one hand, overjoyed to see these guys back alive, but then on the other hand, they're like, what the fuck, you guys left us behind? Because, you know, obviously the whole time that they were left behind, they're like, well, they left us behind. They fucking left us behind. They can't believe it. They just can't believe that the unit left them behind and no one's coming back to get them.
Yep.
And that they had to fight their way out alone. So they confronted the lieutenant, and it led to basically like a food fight and almost like a riot there in this chow hall until they were finally separated. But in the aftermath, what happened was that Rivas and Torres were basically punished for having survived. Stripped of their weapons. They were basically put in quarantine. They were interrogated by military intelligence officers. A bunch of military intelligence officers came down from division headquarters in Baghdad to interview everyone. Obviously, they told us all we were not to speak about this incident to anyone.
And so they wanted to make sure it didn't make it to the media.
And we were ordered in no uncertain terms that we would not speak about this incident, that it was under investigation by MI, and that we were not to speak about it. Rivas and Torres, we didn't see them for about a month after that. They had their weapons taken away and they were placed in some other housing. And, you know, talking to both of those guys years later, you know, they told me that the MI agents were basically casting doubt on their version of events, trying to dissuade them from saying that it happened. And long story short, that never came out. It never emerged, never leaked to the press. And Rivas and Torres didn't get any kind of like medals or recognition for the incredible valor that they displayed. They didn't even get Purple Hearts for their injuries because of some technicality where like there has to be witnesses to show that it was, they said they couldn't prove that it was the result of enemy action, the wounds that they sustained.
And they probably weren't willing to go interview the Mahdi army guys.
I guess not.
They put in Rivas for a Silver Star, but then the 84th downgraded it to bronze, and then the citation was ultimately rejected. For lack of witnesses. That's deranged. It's
unfucking believable. And it really left me with lasting cynicism towards like my own unit and you know the chain of command in general and how that operates, how officers protect their own. You know, the dynamic between officers and enlisted, because at the end of our deployment, all of our officers awarded each other bronze stars, including that lieutenant who left those guys behind.
He got a bronze star. And
And not that it matters, not that it really matters. Like,
it's an insult.
Emphasize.
It's an insult, man.
He said, I was happy to be alive, but at the same time, like, it is an insult. It's an insult. And it goes to show. You know, or it goes to show up or put the lie to certain myths that are very cherished in U.S. military culture, such as we never leave a man behind, or that like officers are out there in the lead,
or like our radios work.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, or that we respond truthfully to FOIA requests. So,
yeah,
yeah. If people want to read more, please check out the article. Like I said, it was the first one I ever wrote for Rolling Stone.
It's a really good article, and it's quite depressing. I mean, you also quote you spoke to a lieutenant colonel who was a philosophy professor at West Point, who writes on battlefield ethics. So this is from, you know, the top of that world, and he tells you the soldier's creed. Does he tell you this, or is this just what he says? The soldier's creed is, quote, aspirational. A, quote, motivational, quote, not a law of war, quote, the job of a commissioned officer is to exercise judgment, not reflexively follow a motto. In other words, fuck you if you believe it. You know, everyone for themselves. I mean, God, that's grim, man.
You know, I can't say I completely disagree with what he's expressing there. Like, you may be put in a position as a military officer. Like, am I going to go drag out two guys' dead bodies, even if it's going to cost me like five guys who get killed? Is that the right choice? I don't know. The thing that really rankled me is the way that they covered it up. And basically punished Rivas and Torres for having inconveniently survived when they were supposed to have been dead. Because we were informed that they were dead. The unit was gathered together and we were told, hey, Rivas.
Oh, you were there when you were told that he was. So you like saw the aftermath of this whole thing personally. Okay. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
That's wild. Yeah.
Yeah. Like I said, I saw them leave out the gate on the way to Umar from Balad. And then when the convoy came back all chewed up, you know, that we were told that Rivas and Torres were dead. So were Medina and Ojeda. And so when they reappeared like 3 days later, it was like they were literally coming back from the dead.
Wow. Oh, shit, you're alive. You know? Yeah. Pretty much.
How long did it take to get new equipment for the, I mean, how long did it take to? I remember there was a lot of talk about up armoring vehicles. Mm-hmm. Did you ever get officially up armored or re-equipped with decent communications?
No, we never had it. Not when I was.
What
there.
Years were you there from?
I was there from December 2003 to March 2005.
That's astonishing.
To make people rich.
I mean, the amount of money they threw at Iraq, but they didn't throw any money at that.
It was part of the mismanagement that prevailed at that time, which got a lot of people killed. They just weren't as good as they thought they were going to be at running a war.
John, I think, and you know, we'll talk about this probably when we talk about the war and some of the, I don't know, thinking going into it, but I think the basic thinking was, we're going to win this fast. They'll be overwhelmed. They'll look to us like white gods. And that's it. Like, why? There's no need to prepare for anything else because everything's going to go great. And anybody who says, but wait a minute, is not with the team. He's got a bad attitude. Mm-hmm. So move him out, put him out to pasture and find somebody who's got a good attitude and just keep zooming along. So I can imagine, right? I mean, I can see that. Corporate thinking, basically.
But I think there's also a procurement. Well, we should get into this later, but there's a reason the F-35 gets paid for, because services always want big ticket, gold-plated items. And the things Gabriel Uriarte, for example, has done some really good work on this. The things that don't get priority are unsexy stuff like radios. Mm-hmm. And armor plating transport vehicles.
That's very true.
It's funny. I mean, the Russians, you know, have had similar problems with their military campaigns. But we get a lot of reporting about the Russian problems, because the implication is, you know, they're so much different, so much worse than we are.
This is something that happens to armies
a lot
everywhere. They want, I mean, it was happening to armies after the Battle of Crecy. Oh boy, that heavy cavalry looks beautiful. Yeah, but shut up. That heavy cavalry looks beautiful. We don't care about any longbows.
The attacks on reserve units that were lacking in armor was also a reflection of the sort of, just the political confusion and just the strategic failure of the war itself, because you know, the fact that the Iraqis didn't want us there after a certain amount of time, and also that they would specifically target non infantry, non combat units, because obviously the insurgents are not stupid.
Right,
they're capable of observing and making smart decisions. Like one of them is like, "Hey, this is a lot easier when we attack these reserve units that don't have armor, instead of the scary-looking infantry columns that have helicopters flying low above them and they're all up armored and bristling with 50-caliber machine guns. Yeah. They're not going to attack that. They're going to attack the soft targets."
I remember that was a big complaint, John, among at least the sort of the pundit and the Republican class, like, wait a minute, this isn't fair. This isn't real because they have to come out and do a set piece battle against us. Otherwise, it's not really happening. It's just fake. It's not fair or something.
Well, when IEDs became the prevailing method of fighting for the insurgency, that really reached a peak. Like, this is not fair.
Therefore, it's not really happening. It doesn't count.
You can't really say that in a war. It always reminds me of that Far Side thing with the wagon train in a circle, and fire arrows are lighting up the covers of the wagon train, and one guy is saying to the other, wait, can they do that?
That's right. I love that one. Let me ask you, as somebody who was there, who joined, so when you joined, you got to Iraq via the National Guard. And when did you...
Reserve, but close enough.
The National Guard Reserve. Is that right?
It's actually different. The reserve is a national formation, and the National Guard units are state. I joined in 2002 after, I mean, it was such, I was thinking this morning, like, it was a long time ago. The first time I'd ever been on a plane was when I went to basic training. And The first time I'd ever left the country was when I went to Iraq. Although that's not true. I've been to Mexico because I live close to the border. But I really had little idea of what I was doing when I signed the paperwork. They make it so easy, you know, after my freshman year of college at UT, I joined the Army Reserve. I don't remember like patriotism, post 9/11 patriotism playing an especially pertinent role in that choice, but I'm sure it must have been there somewhere in the background because of the atmosphere at the time.
Right.
Because of the way the timing works, you know, I couldn't go to basic training until the following summer when I had summer vacation.
Right.
In the interim is to sort of drumbeat towards war with Iraq. So I'm sitting there thinking, well, you know, it's interesting that the whole WMD conspiracy theory and that media phenomenon that it was the, you know, you saw how it was just incredibly alienating and terrifying because you saw how the government was able to sort of use the media as like a puppet or like almost like ventriloquist style to make all of the talking heads talk in the same, talk in a single voice.
Yeah.
But if you had access to the internet, anyone who was interested could look up, quickly find information that showed that this is not true. Like there were a lot of people at the time. It is not at all. The biggest myth we need to fight against is the idea that everyone was fooled.
Yeah, they would love to have that as cover for themselves, for their shilling for the war. That, everyone believed in the WMDs. No, they didn't.
Yeah. They
put a ton of work into shutting up the ones who didn't.
That's right. And you know, just having a normal amount of curiosity at that age, I was able to find information that showed me that this is not true, that they're doing this for some other reason. Especially the thing, because big thing that they emphasized at the time, not just the weapons of mass destruction, but that Saddam Hussein was in league with Al-Qaeda.
Right.
That was a big, important part of it, that was the case was just as much about that as it was about weapons of mass destruction. And that was particularly, like, the weapons of mass destruction thing.
Obviously bullshit, yeah.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Like, you could see that wasn't true at all.
The people in your unit, did any percentage of them believe the prevailing media stories about WMDs and Al-Qaeda?
Yeah, I vividly remember, especially because we were over there during the 2004 election. We were there in November 2004. And so we would have these debates in the barracks. And I remember it being about evenly divided. And I remember real acrimony. I can't remember the guy's name anymore, but there was one guy that I would really get into it about this stuff. Because, you know, I was against the Iraq War from day one. I wrote letters to my college newspaper saying that the WMD Al-Qaeda thing wasn't like arguing with people. Before there was Twitter, you had to write.
Right. You still had to write letters to the editor. Newspaper. Yes.
And they would go on. Ours was called the firing line, the Daily Texan.
The firing line.
You could get into it over a period of weeks. Like I would write a letter and a student would write a letter and I would respond to him and the paper would just keep publishing these responses to one another. So you get into like these extended acrimonious debates with people. But so I was getting into that with you know, people about the Iraq thing. But you know what? I didn't have a choice once I got my orders. Or I guess I could have technically. There was a guy in my unit who dropped a weight on his foot on purpose in order to not have to deploy.
Wow.
And I remember how poor bastard, what they did was they wrapped up his foot, took away his weapon, and said, "You're coming with us, except you're just going to be on, you know, you're going to be sitting in the headquarters building." And the ostracization of him was so, it was sad. It was sad. And I can't even say that I wasn't a part of it, you know. Everyone looked at him as this guy, this total coward. Who had done this thing, injured his foot on purpose to avoid going. McNary was his name. McNary.
Wow.
What was your attitude? Just sort of like, well, I'm against it, but I signed up and it's just the way it goes. You scared? Were you like, I mean,
pretty much that, yeah. Like I don't have a choice. Or they're gonna make my life so miserable it'd be better just to go.
Right.
And yeah, like you said, like I kind of felt like I had done it to myself.
Right.
I really didn't have anyone to blame. about myself.
When your whole culture is telling you go die, I mean, you could blame the whole culture, but
That's true. And I mean, again, I was 19 years old. If you think about the type of decisions you make at that age, they're not always the most reflective.
It's a good age from the recruiter's point of view to go after young males. You know, they're all psychos at that age. So, you know,
there's a great video that's on, I don't know where, TikTok or YouTube or something, where they just go around. It's new. It's from like the modern day army, but they're asking soldiers, if you could say one thing to your recruiter, what would you say? And there's just one guy after another saying, fuck you.
That's funny. So I was telling you before the show, you know, that, I mean, what this story is about is, you know, heroism versus lies and cover-ups and a culture of cover-ups and also just, you know, the cruelty in the sort of hierarchy of the military as well. I was telling you about this piece by Dan Frumkin where he said, you know, the officially 32,000 U.S. servicemen or service people who served in Iraq, there were 32,000 wounded. But unofficially, when you look at the statistics, the number is closer to 500,000 injured one way or another. It just depends on how the injuries are massaged, when they're, you know, so on and so forth. From your experience, were there a lot of, I don't know, stories like, not as dramatic as this, but just a sense of people not being taken care of, people's wounds and conditions and the way they were screwed up by the war being pushed completely off books, things like that? Like, was it pretty common just from your own personal experience or no?
Good question. I'm not sure. Thank God I wasn't injured myself. Right. I know that quite a few guys were. I wouldn't be surprised if there's a lot of type of injuries that you get, like, you know, like back injuries and things like sprains, things that at the time you think you can shake it off, but because you got to realize you're driving around these huge heavy trucks, and bad roads. I mean, I remember one of our dump trucks flipped, and the guys were really banged up. Lucky to be alive. I imagine that, you know, it wasn't as if they were considered wounded in action.
Right.
But I would be shocked if those guys didn't feel those injuries to this day.
Right. Well, and then there's PTSD and all the people who've had depression and suicides and stuff.
There seems to be a lot of evidence that combat experience leads to depression at a level much higher than the general population.
With one qualifier, I would add. It's combat experience that's not connected to a sort of national cause or a cause that you can believe in that can sustain you.
Right.
In the importance of the sacrifice later on. You know, I can't say I'm the biggest fan of, Sebastian Younger wrote a book about specifically this called Tribe. And I think that his thesis is basically correct, where he's saying that, you know, actually human beings can shake off combat pretty easily and can do and see and witness horrible things if they are returning to basically a tribal context in which they know that they've sacrificed for a cause and that everyone else was in it with them. And, you know, one thing we can say about America's wars after 9/11 is that sure as hell is not the case.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, there's another factor in counting injuries, which seemed to be highlighted during the burn pit scandal. Like, what are you calling an injury? I mean, you may not even know, or you may hide in the elite the knowledge that something is an injury. And then it will turn out that a lot of people who got burn pit duty are suffering the same illnesses as people who get stuck with the job of cleaning up fire sites.
You know, it's funny, I actually worked a lot in a burn pit and because we were engineers and so we had a lot of heavy earth moving equipment, which was always in demand in kind of crazy ways. Actually, I'll say two things about that. It actually took us to some significant back sites of the war in 2004, which was a pivotal year in the war. Mm-hmm. We went to Samara because after the 1st Infantry Division, Samara was the first city to fall to Al Qaeda in Iraq, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi's group, which would later become ISIS, of course. Mm-hmm. And the 1st Infantry Division assaulted Samara in October 2004 to take it back. And this is in the lead up to the Battle of Fallujah. And my unit, including me personally, we were sent in during the battle in order to lay gravel on top of, because they seized this like police station in the city center and they were using it as their forward operating base to do patrols. And it was filled with this dust. It was a very lightweight dust, the consistency of talcum powder. And with the tanks driving around, it made it, stirred up so much dust, it made it impossible to breathe. And so we rather ridiculously were called in a sort of reserve unit again, called in to dump, haul one load of gravel after another, like for days on end and weeks on end, just hauling gravel from a quarry north of Samara into that police station in the downtown Jeez. Area.
Wow.
In order to suppress the dust.
How many people got shot at from that?
I mean, well, that was when I was saying earlier about taking that round to the
right.
door oh, of my yeah. of my truck. But the convoys were very long, but we would have to dismount and we'd be shooting alongside the infantry guys who were blocking the alleyways and so forth. It was just chaos. It felt like pure chaos at the time. I'm sure somebody was. And you know, that operation actually went well. It was easier than Fallujah, but being there on the ground, it seemed like pure chaos. But later we went to Fallujah to, it's rather grisly or ghastly, but you know, to dig mass graves.
Your unit?
Yeah, my unit dug the graves.
Wow.
Outside the city, because they had a lot of bodies, many, many bodies. And
whose bodies?
Leave them in the streets. The bodies of, basically all of the men of military age, they would call them.
Right.
Men and boys between 15 and... Because before they assaulted Fallujah in November 2004, they had the city surrounded. And this is something I've asked everyone that... Because it was just a rumor in the early days, but I'm satisfied now after all these years of talking to people that this is how it actually happened. They refused, or they turned back any... males that were trying to leave the city.
Right.
They let the women and children leave, but none of the boys and men could leave Fallujah before they assaulted it.
They were meant to be killed.
They were given no choice but to stay and fight.
Mm. And which is so they were meant to be killed. I mean,
right. Yeah. And they went house to house, and you know, some of them were taken captive.
Okay.
They didn't just murder everybody, but they definitely killed the majority of the town's or the city's male inhabitants. And that was really the peak of violence in Iraq. We were called in just because, you know, they had to dispose of those bodies.
Did you get to see, did you get to see the city? I mean, it was, as I understand it, I don't know, 90% of the buildings were destroyed.
No, I wasn't part of that element that was there. Because, you know, they would just grab 5 guys, 10 guys.
So you were just too far on the outskirts.
No, I wasn't even sent to Fallujah. Just a couple of my, a couple of guys from my platoon went there. Again, it all depended on the. I drove something called an M1075 PLS. And so that wasn't needed. It's kind of has a hydraulic crane on the back. And so. The guys that went to Fallujah were guys who drove bulldozers and front end loaders and excavators, things like that.
Right.
Or the trucks to haul them, the low boy trucks to haul them. So I wasn't there, but I heard about it firsthand from the guys that had been there.
I got to say, when the Battle of Mariupol was happening, I think it was in that time, all over social media, you had people, a lot of blue checks, military blue checks and so on, saying like, you know, this is the most evil, what Russia's doing. And I don't mean to justify it because I've said from the beginning the war is a crime. You know, the invasion is criminal, whatever. But I can't stand this historical revisionism. It drives me nuts. I mean, if the lesson we learn is we're good, they're bad, then it's all wrong. And they were making it seem like there were people saying directly, the U.S. never does this and has never done this. It's never razed a city to the ground. And people started saying, a lot of people were, you know, most people were retweeting and affirming and yeah, the Russians. And then a few people would be like, well, what about Fallujah? You know, and then you go online and you look and you try and look up Fallujah and what really went on there. I mean, you're alluding to some of this here where I've read this in another account too by an Iraqi journalist. They surrounded the city completely, put it, you know, fenced it off completely, walled it off with armor and so on, and would not let out fighting age males. And so they couldn't get out even if they wanted to. You know, and the city was razed to the ground and white phosphorus and so on and so forth. And people reminded them, like, that city was completely destroyed. That's how, you know, unfortunately, that's like how urban warfare goes. You know, you just shouldn't be invading in the first place. But, like, it's not unusual when you actually get down to the urban warfare. And it's just surprising. Like, there's no, looking back on it, there's no real, like, I don't know, like with something with, I don't know, the Vietnam War, some other battles or something I can't think of right now. But there's no real account that you can look up and say, yeah, this is really what happened in Fallujah. And it was, you know, just the basics, like all these people were killed, all these buildings were destroyed, you know, like East Aleppo kind of thing, or what we got from East Aleppo or Grozny or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, on the Wikipedia page for the Battle of Fallujah, it says that 800...
Right.
Enemy were killed.
Right.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. Based on the Iraq body count, which is
right.
You know, before there were OSINT psyops like Bellingcat or
right.
What's the other one? Institute for the Study of War.
Yeah.
It was the Iraq Body Count Project, which seemed like a neutral organization, but sort of systematically seeded the internet with a order of magnitude undercounts. And their methodology was that they just counted from news articles. They counted people that had been killed. So if there was an AP article that said, you know, 30 insurgents were killed and one Marine died or something like that, then that was and it was just basically a project of addition using all of those that they could, putting them together. So what I'm saying is should be obvious is that this methodology results in a clear undercount, because you're missing everything that hasn't been written about or reported on. Anyway, it's a real serious count would have involved, you know, a study involving hospitals and morticians and death records, things like that. There's never been anything remotely similar.
I seem to recall the Iraq body count when it was called out at some point 10, 15 years ago, and it turned out they got hundreds of thousands of dollars of government funding. And they reacted kind of like Bellingcat. Yeah, I think it was through the U.S. Institute of Peace. It was one of these groups set up by Bill Casey. And the reaction was, and you see this sometimes, as if us getting money from them had any influence on us. That's just a smear. It's like, well, actually, it does have an influence on you. Money tends to do that, you know?
Yeah.
And also the reason they're giving you money, like, why are they giving you money? Mm-hmm. Anyway,
I think it was when the Lancet came out with its own count that people started to doubt the Iraq body count. But
Well, the Iraq body counts, they by their own admission, they say that hey, this is necessarily an undercount, but it doesn't stop it from being just sort of when people are just casually looking for a source to cite.
Yep,
it works to get to, like as I said, to sort of see the internet with all those undercounts, but I do think that the Battle of Fallujah has come to stand in people's imaginations and a sort of cultural memory as, you know, a real atrocity or just peak violence in this war that went all wrong. And, you know, you're talking about the comparison with Mariupol. Well, there was also the Battle of Mosul in 2015 or 16, although that was done through proxy forces. It wasn't, not entirely through proxy forces, primarily.
Right.
Also the Battle of Raqqa, you know, these are high water marks of urban combat in the 21st century.
Yeah, Coburn did some good articles on how little attention those got compared to East Aleppo, which was happening at the same time. But East Aleppo was more politically convenient, of course.
Well, they had, by that point, moved to the new model of U.S. warfare, which is proxy warfare, managed by special forces and managed by intelligence agencies, often supported by the U.S. Air Force. And that new paradigm of warfighting comes directly out of the Iraq War and the surge of 2007 and 2008.
Right. That leads me to one question I wanted to ask you. Sorry to keep you so long, but did your unit's behavior, doctrine, equipment change in the time you were there?
Not my particular unit. Our whole chain of command was relieved at one point because we were just a clusterfuck. But that was kind of a local issue. No, there's no. I don't think that change happens on the unit level. You're in for a deployment with your chain of command and your guys, and you kind of don't change for that course of that deployment. But now there is change you see at a higher level, over longer time periods. You know, and the main thing that they changed as a result of the Iraq War was to stop using conventional units and start relying on JSOC and on special forces and SOCOM units more generally, and having proxy forces do the real fighting and just manage it from afar and keep it all secret. So the second or the third Iraq War, or however you want to call it, the anti-ISIS war from 2015 to 2018, was entirely prosecuted by JSOC, and everything about it was kept secret. And so that's why, you know, you mentioned a moment ago that, you know, there's almost no reporting around that. From the perspective of the managers and planners of these things, it was much more successful.
Yes. It was surprising to me, again, to see through social media interactions how few people really, people who are supposed to know and who should know, maybe didn't want to, but how few people really knew the condition, like what was done to Mosul and Raqqa. I mean, you may support it or not support it, but you also need to know what was done to pacify those cities and, you know, take ISIS out. They destroyed those cities. They leveled them completely and killed a lot of civilians, and they just kept it from us. And that model works pretty well. Like it's like information is like a spigot that they can turn on and off, using some of their go-betweens, like, and their cutouts, like, you know, in the OSINT world and so on. So you can flood people with some information and just hide other information. They have it down. They seem to have it down pretty well.
They really do. And, you know, I think an important point to emphasize about the Iraq War on the 20th anniversary of the invasion is that the Iraq War never ended. It didn't end in the way that the Vietnam War ended, because there's still U.S. troops in Iraq right now, thousands of them.
That's a great
point. They're still fighting, and now it's spilled over into Syria, and we have U.S. troops occupying a third of Syria. And they're not just sitting around monitoring the highways, you know, from Tehran to Damascus at the Tamp crossing or whatever. They're actually doing operations. And every once in a while, SOCOM will put out, or every month, in fact, SOCOM will put out its list of operations that month. They're doing unilateral lethal operations. So JSOC guys, Delta Force guys are going out killing Iraqis and Syrians on a weekly basis in Iraq and in Syria. And in fact, three Delta Force soldiers were just wounded in Syria and Deir ez-Zor, if I'm not mistaken, just about 3 weeks ago, along with one of their working dogs. So that tells you that the kind of work that's still going on in the background, just under the veil of special operations secrecy, that is basically gets a pass and exempted from reporting on, in the mainstream media.
Right. Okay, I think we can wrap this up. This was a great talk. Thanks for talking to us, Seth, and telling us about your experience in Iraq. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
Quick question. Do you have anything in the works right now? I mean, I know you've been writing about the Fort Bragg murders and all the insanity that is going on. I wouldn't even know what to characterize it as right now. But are you working on that? Are you working on anything else?
I'm working on a book, really focused on the book, just trying to finish it.
Okay.
Not really doing anything else at the moment, but looking forward to it when it comes out.
And definitely.
Thank you guys so much for all the great coverage y'all do. I really depend on your coverage to give me updates for what's going on in Ukraine. Kind of checked out otherwise, but you know, y'all's episodes on it keep me attuned to events there. And also the Eritrean Ethiopian war, I've been finding those episodes really interesting as well. Thanks. Since nobody else is talking about it.
Nobody.
Yeah, I know. It's amazing. Yeah. So. Thanks, Seth. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
All right.
Thanks for joining us.
Yeah,
all right. Take care.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, that was our interview with Seth Harp, contributing editor to Rolling Stone and friend of the show. That was a great interview. Actually, we initially thought we were going to just talk to him for about, you know, 20, 30 minutes. I know he was a little under the weather too. Well, we all kind of are, one way or another, to kind of set up things we were going to talk about, which is sort of the Iraq War, our memories of it, what it looked like from Russia.
And the media's...
Yeah.
The media's memory of it. I mean, how they, as we say, framed the experience.
Their lived experience at the time. But the interview, because it was so interesting, the stories he told and just kind of getting really that first-person story of somebody who was there, it just went on longer and it was a lot more interesting than we thought. So rather than, making this like a 2.5-hour episode, I think we can wrap it up now and then we'll do part two. in a separate episode, which is going to be more about the stories that we've collected. Again, what we saw from Russia and also what we would like to remember that they would like us not to remember, I think is sort of how to put it.
Right. If nothing else, the Iraq War generated some of the most astonishing, not in a good way, but astonishing media coverage of history, really. And we got to go back through that.
And then people covering up their past and some thread. There are Russia threads before, through Kosovo, through Putin's opposition to the Iraq War, and then up through some of the same people 20 years ago reappearing as sort of rewashing their reputations now as, you know, cheerleaders for the Ukraine war. And these are some of the same villains. Yeah. You know, and then you have people like Michael McFaul. We'll get into this in the next episode. Michael McFaul, who's literally just came out and lied straight up when the Russian invasion happened, claiming he was a big opponent of the Iraq war. And we'll talk about that. We'll see what Mikey really had to say when that war was going on.
Yeah, there's plenty of indictments to go around. Some of them hilarious, some of them kind of disgusting.
A lot of them both at the same time. Anyway, so we'll wrap it up. Thanks again, Seth Harp, our guest, for coming on. We'll post the link as well to his article in Rolling Stone that we discussed. And anyway, talk to you again soon. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everybody. Bye.